This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
This is a historic moment. The arrival of the North Vietnamese regular army in Saigon.
40 years ago this week, Saigon fell to the Viet Cong. As tanks rolled toward the capital, American civilians, soldiers, and tens of thousands of South Vietnamese were airlifted out in the largest helicopter evacuation in history. Between 2,000 and 3,000 children, some fathered by U.S. servicemen, others said to be orphaned in the war, were swept into planes that carried them to safety in homes in America, Australia, Canada, and Europe. Here's a clip from a British TV report on the 99 children carried to the UK.
Many argue they would be better left in Vietnam, particularly if the communists take over, because their social services can only be an improvement on the South's. And if peace comes, the children's large families would eventually reclaim them. Others argue the Vietnamese families have been irrevocably scattered by the war, and that placing in a good new family, even if Christian and not Buddhist, must be better than life in an orphanage, however well run.
Dana Sachs took 6 years to investigate why those children were taken from their home. She wrote about it in the book The Life We Were Given, Operation Babylift, International Adoption, and the Children of the War in Vietnam. We spoke with her and with Bert Ballard, who was among the children airlifted from Saigon when the book was first released. Here's Dana describing the image that launched her inquiry.
Well, I was doing research on adoption from Vietnam, contemporary adoption, and I happened to see a photograph of babies on an airplane, and each child was wrapped in swaddling clothes and was on a different seat of an airplane. And I thought it was such a strange photograph, so I tried to investigate and figure out what it was from, and I found out that there had been this evacuation of children from Vietnam at the very end of the war there, and that 2,000 or 3,000 had been airlifted and put into adoptive homes overseas. And I was really puzzled by that because I thought, wow, the country was about to be at peace for the first time in 30 years. Why was there this airlift of children out at that moment?
But Bert, you write on the book jacket that Operation Babylift was, quote, presented as a great humanitarian effort. Presented. What do you think it was really about?
Oh, I think there was a lot of politicians using it to demonstrate, say, from the United States, you know, a good thing that happened over in Vietnam. If you listen to the North Vietnamese perspective on it, it was a big kidnapping or something very illegal in terms of removing a generation of children from their country. I think it very much depends on the perspective of where people are coming from.
Well, it certainly was high drama. International media picked up the pictures of these teeny kids that Dana later saw, looking bewildered. One plane, the largest aircraft in the world at the time, crashed, killing more than 100 people aboard. Many of the children airlifted were of mixed race, raising fears that they would be punished by the incoming North Vietnamese. Dana, what other reasons were given for getting these children out of Saigon?
Well, I think the main reason that was given was that the adoption agencies that had been running orphanages in Vietnam said that they had already arranged the adoptions of these children and they had no parents in Vietnam. And so they were making an effort to get them to their new families before Saigon fell. But it was really maybe only 80% at the most of the children who were on the airlift who really were living in orphanages before the evacuation. And a lot of other children ended up on the planes at the last minute because their parents panicked.
And Dana, in fact, you later quoted a lawyer who compared this to the situation where a house is burning. You hand your baby out to somebody who can keep it safe, but then when you get out, you want the baby back.
Right. This is one of the lawyers who filed a lawsuit to have all the children's documentation investigated to make sure that they really were eligible for adoption. And that's what he said. He was arguing that everything needed to be looked into more closely because there were going to be parents who changed their minds after they saw that their children wouldn't be killed when the communists took over and they would want their children back.
Bert, you were thought to have been about 6 weeks old when you were handed over to Colleen and Jerry Ballard, a woman who admits in the book that she really had no idea what she was doing as a real mother. Did you grow up with people who looked like you?
No, I did not. You know, from the video clip that you played earlier about parents wanting to come back and reclaim their children, that was actually an experience my mom had while we were in Georgia. When the FBI visited her and asked to look me over for distinguishing marks in case any parents made cases or claims with the State Department to reclaim me. And I think that what that did was cause a lot of parents of the children of the baby lift to mainstream us, to try to quote-unquote hide us in some respect, to normalize us so we would blend in. And unlike today's, I think, adoptive parents, where there's a lot of education and a lot of effort for post-adoption resources and connecting with culture and other adoptees, that just wasn't something that happened quite as much with certainly us as Vietnamese adoptees.
Well, Bert, you were presented as Vu Tien Do too, because there were actually two boys with the same name. What do you know about your birth family?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
I know absolutely nothing. And recently I discovered that there were not two Vu Tien Dos at the original orphanage that I was at. And even the woman who helped evacuate me, Betty Tisdale, is not sure where the two came from. One of the stories she tells me is I may have been handed over in all of the chaos. So whether I was even at the orphanage or not even remains a mystery to me to this day.
Dana, you've spoken to a couple of dozen adoptees at length to find out their stories, found many different responses, anger, grief, a kind of lack of attachment, a curiosity about the birth family. I'd love to hear some of their stories, like that of one young woman. Her name, given name, was Nop An, called An. She was adopted by the Gelbwax family of Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about An's history.
Well, I was able to hear her story because I met her birth mother first when I was doing research in Vietnam. And her birth mother, whose name is Han, told me the story of panicking at the end of the war and being worried that her Amerasian daughter, who had blonde hair, was going to be killed by the communists. So she went to an enormous effort to get her daughter down to Saigon and onto a plane. And then for years, she grieved the fact that she lost her daughter. And in the early 1990s, when Vietnam began to open up to the West, she and other birth mothers in the city of Da Nang began to walk through the city, and when they found Westerners, they would go up to them and say, "Can you help me find my child?" And she was just lucky because after many months of searching, she met a man who worked for the Red Cross, and a few months later, An, who was living in Superior, Wisconsin, was contacted by the Red Cross, who said that they had contact information on her mother, and so they were able to reunite, which was beautiful.
An was in her 20s when she was discovered. So for these many years, her mother had still been continuing to search for her.
Oh, yeah, and I heard a lot of stories like that in Vietnam of mothers who were still really grieving the loss of their children. And I think that, I mean, I think it's important to say that one of the problems here was that Operation Baby Lift was one of the first time, or maybe the first time, that the emphasis of the evacuation was on adoption and not on just taking children out of a dangerous situation and getting them to safety. So there was no mechanism provided by the U.S. government or the South Vietnamese government to try to figure out what these children's histories really were after the war. It was just get them into adoptive homes as quickly as possible.
We're speaking with the journalist and author Dana Sachs about Operation Baby Lift, which extracted thousands of children out of Vietnam before the fall of Saigon 40 years ago this week. Also with us is Bert Ballard. He's among the children airlifted from Saigon. He was taken at 6 months old and placed with a family in Georgia. Well, this was not without controversy at the time. There were a number of individual cases of families trying to find their children that had been given up. Also, a class action lawsuit against Henry Kissinger, James Schlesinger, and other high-level officials on behalf of three siblings who were old enough to tell a nurse in San Francisco that they were not indeed orphans and they wanted to go home. Between 10 to 20 birth families from Vietnam fought to get their children back. The class action lawsuit was a bit tougher. Now, Dana, what does the Geneva Convention say about birth parents relinquishing children in wartime? What kind of rights do they have once the peace is won?
Well, the idea of the Geneva Convention is that families should be protected, and if they are taken into a situation like, say, for example, a refugee camp or something, that efforts need to be made to preserve the biological family. And so the class action lawsuit was basically appealing to that idea and saying that each of these cases of children needed to be investigated to make sure that they were actually eligible for adoption and had not been given up by their parents in a time of panic, because that's not considered a legal way of giving up a child.
Well, some supporters of the lawsuit did point out that it is highly unnatural for Vietnamese to give up their children. And in fact, there's a great tradition there of taking care of orphans. Others had a different opinion, like Rosemary Taylor. She was one of the champions of Operation Baby Lift. What did she think?
She had lived in Vietnam for, I think, 7 or 8 years and had been working for the adoption movement. And she felt like Vietnamese, I don't want to put words into her mouth, but she did not have as highly positive a view of how Vietnamese treated their children. I thought it was interesting. One of the statistics that I found said that, there were 800,000 displaced children in Vietnam by the time the war ended. I read that 20% of Vietnamese families had an orphan living with them. So to the extent that anybody was really taking care of this problem of displaced children, it was the Vietnamese families themselves, one by one, child by child.
Well, I guess the question here is, what is in the best interest of the child? Was it right to take these children from this country?
You know, that's a difficult question. And I think the great thing that Dana's book does is it doesn't say whether it was right or wrong, but presents so many different viewpoints of people that were involved. Was it right? Was it wrong? I mean, I certainly have lived a wonderful life, and I think many other adoptees would say that as well. But there are costs to those decisions that were made in that haste on us. I have to come to terms with what happened. And it's very easy as an adoptee to get caught up and say, I'm angry, I'm bitter, I don't know these answers, these politicians use me in this way, bad decisions were made, people are putting their own agendas, whatever. But at some point for me, I have to say, okay, this is the life I've been given, and I have to move forward with that. And it doesn't mean that I can't be angry, but at some point I have to make a decision about what am I going to do with this? How am I going to get involved? How am I going to change my story and educate others or be in support of others and hope that these kinds of mistakes and these kinds of situations either don't happen again or if they do, that we can do the process a little bit better.
That was our earlier conversation with Dana Sachs, author of The Life We Were Given, an investigative account of Operation Baby Lift, which extracted thousands of children out of Vietnam before the fall of Saigon 40 years ago this week. Bert Ballard also joins us. He was airlifted from Saigon in April of 1975 and raised in Georgia. He's currently an academic at Pepperdine University and a blogger and adoption advocate. Up next, the story of a refugee of the Vietnam War who helped her extended family and fellow villagers by opening a salon and spa in the United States. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
Lily Pyle was among 5,000 Vietnamese women who came to the U.S. between 1971 and 75 after marrying U.S. servicemen. While starting a new life in America meant she had to leave behind her family, she never severed the ties with her home country. Sarah Hoover brings us her story.
I'm used to it now. I have been cutting it a little bit, as you can see.
All the time, I told you, this is my job, not yours.
I know, but I don't listen.
Lily Pyle cuts hair all day, but she's not just skilled with scissors. This hairstylist also has combat training.
Kill with gun, without gun, all that stuff.
Lily is petite, 5 foot tall, and her ebony hair falls to her waist. She's 60 years old and has lived in the United States for more than 40 years. But her Portland salon walls are covered with photographs from her homeland of Vietnam. In one picture, Lily looks no more than 17. She wears a black uniform and holds an M16 rifle. She stands next to a friend also holding an M16.
We were child soldiers for several years, and this picture, they were training us for higher, more power gun.
Lily grew up on her parents' rice farm. She was born Wang Thi Son. She had to fetch water, take care of her 9 siblings, and cook and clean. Her father, a policeman, was strict with his oldest daughter. He wanted her to stay in the house where she couldn't get into trouble. But that changed when the Americans built a military base next to their village. Dong Ha was a beautiful pastoral village, but it happened to be located right next to the DMZ, the demilitarized zone that divided North and South Vietnam.
I remember at nighttime, we would just stay out on the fence all night long if possible to defend it with the American soldier that guarding. Midnight, they call chow time. They're feeding the soldier, and we would love to eat their food while we're trading them our food.
Lily's village fought on the South Vietnamese side and supported the U.S. troops. For Lily, time spent with the troops was an adventure. She rode into the mountains and filled sandbags. She got a job on the base working for the GIs. As the oldest child, it was her duty to support her family. But she also had a duty to her village. With half the men away in the army, the town recruited teenagers under 18 to defend it.
Growing up, as a girl, my father never let me out at night. I never go anywhere. We don't allow the day or even be anywhere near boy or anything. But to be a combat woman, shoulder to shoulder with men, it was the best thing ever happened to me to get out of that house, to join the guy.
Lily relished the opportunity.
To learn how to shoot and survive and all that, I thought that was the greatest thing, a great memory in my childhood to grow up and be a soldier woman. That was fun. But took care of the 8, 7 brothers and sisters wasn't fun. In Buffalo and all that, it wasn't fun.
The new American base gave her increased independence, but it also put her in more danger. Skirmishes between the U.S. and the Viet Cong escalated. The Viet Cong launched rockets at the village. By age 14, Lily and other kids rushed to put out burning debris before it set straw roofs on fire. They wrapped the bodies of the dead and took them to the center of town for families to find. They also had to watch and make sure the Viet Cong didn't infiltrate the village, which was the base's first line of defense.
They came into the village as much as they can, close as they can, to aim the hand grenade to kill American. But it never happened. They had to shoot it so far away, it dropping all the village and kill the village instead, and hardly ever reach the American. That how much that the little kid like me back then would give Americans safe.
Lily's childhood was a mixture of horror and happiness. She witnessed villagers and American soldiers shot dead or blown up in front of her eyes. But there were lighter moments, too, like her first kiss with a GI or her first crush serenading her.
Let me tell you about the bird and the bee, the flower and the tree.
She forged close bonds with the GIs and saw them off before combat. Often, they didn't come back. Their sacrifice was something she didn't fully understand at the time.
Now I'm older. I have more time in my hand. My children are growing and gone. And the minute I am by myself without anything to tend to, a lot of time to think about things like that, that it really broken my heart. But not something that I can put it out of my mind. But now and then, I look back, sad. But I'm here now, and I learned that nobody in the world, and I understand that nobody in the world would do the thing that Americans do for other country.
Lily's American patriotism is strong. To her, the Americans saved the South Vietnamese lives, but ultimately, they couldn't save her village. In April of 1972, the North Vietnamese Army marched south in an attack known as the Easter Offensive. Dong Ha was one of the first villages they reached, and the Americans bombed in response. This official U.S. broadcast warns of imminent bombings. It threatened the Viet Cong and appealed to villagers to stay and fight. Lily's home was destroyed. Only a crater remained. Her family was separated in the chaos and reunited 3 weeks later at a refugee camp. Even without a home, Lily continued to work for nearby troops. One GI, Larry Pyle, proposed to Lily more than once. She eventually accepted, but was reluctant to leave.
Families are very important to me. I never want to leave my family anything. So at that time, I'm the older. I need to save my family. So I must go to find a job, send money home to save them. So a lot of reason, so I went.
Lily was one of 5,000 war brides from Vietnam to come to America between 1971 and 1975. The couple had 2 children, but divorced 8 years later. Lily's survivor instincts kicked in once again. She learned English and gained her U.S. citizenship after the divorce. she earned the equivalent of a high school diploma and put herself through cosmetology school. She worked several jobs to ensure her children had what they needed. Lily's daughter, Lisa Meza, remembers one Christmas.
My brother wanted a football and I wanted a Cabbage Patch Kid because it was when Cabbage Patch Kids first came out. And, you know, I didn't know that we didn't have the money. I didn't know that they were $100 or more than that, I think, at the time. So my mom entered every single raffle, I think, in the state of Maine to try to win one. And she actually was able to win one for me.
For more than 40 years, Lily has been supporting two families on two continents. She remains a loyal Vietnamese daughter, but also an American mother. Her relationship with her homeland is complex. Her childhood memories are intertwined with the savage acts of war. And when she visits Vietnam, she can still see its effects. That's why she started Vietnamese Hope Foundation, a nonprofit to address the poverty in her village. It keeps her connected to a place she never wanted to leave. But she did leave, and sometimes that cost seems too high, like 25 years away and missing her dying father's last wish.
When you have to sacrifice something so big for freedom, it isn't worth the freedom, as far as I'm concerned, especially from your heart. Everyone wanted to live and die where they were born.
Lily plans to retire to Vietnam in a few years. She's now remarried, and the couple owns a home in Dang Ha, her home village. Bomb craters still litter the area. A tree now grows where Lily's childhood home once stood. Her foundation repairs craters and provides food and supplies to the townspeople. One of the ways she fundraises is at her salon. Customers can have the proceeds of their haircut go towards her foundation. Today, Bruce Cargill sits in Lily's chair. He flew 1,000 combat hours in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot. As Lily cuts, they reminisce.
And you know what? I did it because the fact that you were a veteran.
For Salt Radio, I'm Sarah Hoover.
There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine this. You take a cute or funny photo of your pet. You upload it to the social media site of your choice. Maybe you show it to friends and they all comment on how adorable it is. And then you move on to other things. Meanwhile, in the deep recesses of the internet, someone sees this photo and decides to caption it. Maybe they give your pet a new name, and suddenly your adorable dog or cat is the next big thing on the internet, a viral meme. You may even get offered a deal from an ad agency that would make your pet a star in the real world. For some, it sounds like a dream come true, but for one woman, it felt much more like a nightmare. Carl Cheka wrote, "Wow, scare, amaze. That's what it's like when your pet goes viral," for Matter.com. Kyle, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right, so bring us back to the beginning and describe this Doge meme for those who have not seen it.
So the Doge meme is this very funny photo of a Shiba Inu dog, which is a breed of dog that's native to Japan. And in every image of this meme, there's a photo of a Shiba Inu, and then on top of the photo, there are these strange phrases written in Comic Sans typeface, like, "Wow, such a maze, so scare." And they kind of narrate what people think the dog might be saying or thinking.
So they're kind of monologue captions of the dog, but I would say done in the, let's say, lowest common denominator of cultural stereotype of how Japanese people talk?
It could be seen that way. I think I'm not convinced that it's totally connected to Japanese people. I think it's more of a goofy kind of lolcat type of talking, you know, kind of the baseline of internet humor, let's say. This is a silly, agrammatical form of writing.
And it's turned into a viral meme. You see the dog's face kind of photoshopped onto a Twinkie or a giant rock or a landscape or a Christmas sweater. But give us the origin story on this. How did it start?
The origin story of Doge is really interesting because the actual dog that appears in the original Doge photo, her owner had no idea that this meme actually existed. So this woman who lives outside of Tokyo named Atsuko Saito is a kindergarten teacher, and she rescued a Shiba Inu dog from a puppy mill. And so she lived with this dog happily, and she started this blog of photos of the dog. And she just posts photos of her and the dog, who's named Kobozu, playing outside and frolicking in the park and, you know, doing all sorts of things. And then one day she took this single photo of Kobozu sitting on the couch, kind of paws crossed, glaring balefully out at the viewer. And that image kind of went forth from Atsuko's blog and went totally viral. No one knows exactly how, but it showed up on 4chan and Reddit and all these different internet community sites. And over time, that single image evolved into the Doge meme, which kind of transforms Kobozu the dog into a wacky cartoon character.
What was Atsuko's response when she saw her dog all over the internet?
At first, Atsuko was totally freaked out. When I originally told her that this meme existed, she said she had seen these weird photos of Kobozu showing up, but had no idea what they meant. And so in talking to her, I realized that she was just totally scared that an image from her private life, like a photo that she shot within her own home, went totally viral and millions of people all over the internet could see it. And I think it scared her a little bit that Kobozu, the dog, had this other life that she didn't know about at all.
But her dog was already pretty internet famous, let's say, in Japan. She had a blog featuring photos of her pets, got a small but devoted fan base. Why did she find this memification of her dog so freaky, as you say?
Let's see. I mean, I think Atsuko was comfortable with her blog because she knew she could completely control it. And the photos that she posted were always very cute and nice. And I think when she started seeing the meme images of Kobozu's head photoshopped onto weird things like we've been talking about, it seemed more frightening than cute, I think. Something I heard a lot from her and her fans was that they didn't think these images of Doge were cute at all. They thought they were actually kind of freaky and frightening. So I think in some sense she realized she had lost control over what she had put online.
You broke the story on Verge. You found her, you tracked her down and presented her with this. It seems like an object lesson on things taking on a life of their own on the internet, you know, out of her control. So if you were her, if you were Atsuko's PR agent, what would you recommend she do?
I mean, I think she could react in one of two ways. The first is to totally ignore it and just hope it goes away. And just not deal with this Doge meme on the U.S. internet, which is pretty separate from her day-to-day life. Or she could kind of go with the flow and realize that Doge is a pretty harmless thing. It's a funny internet meme and a joke that a lot of people really love. And she could actually embrace it and turn Kobozu into kind of an even more famous dog.
So Atsuko was frightened, clearly, by the amount of attention she got, but she also got some offers to make money off of this. Did she take them up?
I think her initial reaction was that she didn't want anything to do with the commercial offers, which came from dog food brands and dog leash companies and even a kind of card game accessory company. But Atsuko is a super nice human being. And her main goal with promoting Kobozu online is to actually raise awareness for or against puppy mills. So in the end, she took some of these commercial offers and has licensed her image to be used commercially in order to donate more money to dog charities in Japan.
Is the Doge meme still popular?
I think the Doge meme is popular. You still see it popping up in different places on the internet. But its popularity is definitely waning. I think internet memes always have kind of a half-life after which they fall out of popularity. And Doge's popularity actually peaked right around the time that that I published that first article on Kobozu's identity. So after that, which was around December 2013, it's definitely fallen off. You can see in like the Google search results or the search metrics that less people are interested in Doge. But I think if you're on the internet enough, you still see those weird photos of Shiba Inu and the strange speech patterns popping up all over the place.
Thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Kyle Chake is a freelance writer for Newsweek, Matter, Pacific Standard, among other publications. We found his article, Wow, Scare, Amaze. That's what it's like when your pet goes viral, on Matter.com. You'll find a link to his article and see the Doge memes for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. DJ, producer, and electronic musician Juan McLean has also developed a fiercely loyal international fan base. He's performed at clubs across the world. But when he's not jet-setting around the globe, he lives under the radar in New Hampshire. A conversation with Juan McLean when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The track, A Place Called Space, conjures the neon lights, white linen suits, and high-speed chases of Miami Vice. But while its 80s-inspired dance beat may seem at home at the clubs of Ibiza, it was conceived right here in the wilds of New Hampshire by Juan McLean. Juan is a DJ, producer, electronic musician, and the creative force behind The Juan McLean with Nancy Wang. When their third album, In a Dream, was released last September, it received loads of love from music critics. Pitchfork Media described it as high-def synth boogie, flexing and preening in ways its forebears simply couldn't. Stereogum deemed it more varied and omnivorous than anything else The Juan McLean has done before. Together, Nancy and Juan make The Juan McLean, which will be performing at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth tonight. He joined us in the studio when the album was first released. So you're an electronic musician. You've got gigs all over major U.S. cities, U.S. capitals. You're heading off to a European tour in November. Yet you're living in Dover, New Hampshire. Are you leading a double life?
Yeah, I do. I do lead somewhat of a double life. For someone like me, it's typical that I would live in, you know, New York or Berlin or somewhere like that, but I actually live
in a really beautiful apartment.
Yeah, in an amazing apartment, maybe with a doorman. But I actually live in Dover, New Hampshire, and I have since 1999.
So how'd that happen?
I was in between music careers, and my girlfriend at the time was pregnant with our first child, and her family lived in York, in Maine, and my parents lived a little bit north of Boston, so we moved from Providence, Rhode Island, up here to be closer to them.
So does living so close to a rural environment, to the natural world, do anything for your creative process?
Yeah, I've actually thought a lot about this over the years because there, I definitely go through phases where I wish I were living in New York. And I think that living in an area like this gives me a lot of sort of breathing room. I think if I lived in a more urban environment like New York or London or Berlin, I would get really caught up in, you know, the frenzy of the city. And being here allows me to sit back a little bit more and, like, not have all those influences coming at me all the time.
Do your neighbors know what you do?
No, it's funny. I felt like I was hiding out here for a long time, and then...
Like that guy from The Sopranos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly, for less nefarious reasons. But they, every once in a while, someone would stop me, like, on the street. Someone would say, hey, what are you doing in this area? Like, are you on your way somewhere and stop by or something? And I'd tell them that I live here, and they wouldn't believe it, basically.
Well, you are known as an electronic musician and DJ, but in the early 90s, you were a guitarist in a band called Six Finger Satellite. Now, you were on Sub Pop Records.
Same.
People may know that as the same label that signed Nirvana. Let's just hear a little bit of that music from that time. So that's really different from the first track that we heard. Can you talk a little bit about your creative evolution from this, you know, post-punk to dance music?
Well, it's funny because I think of it as just sort of a 180 reversal of very similar elements. Because post-punk had a lot of, like, disco and dance and funk influences. It was a lot of like disco rhythmic backbeats with really angular guitars and electronics as well. And so Six Finger Satellite was like a post-punk band with dance elements, and the Juan McLean is like a dance music oriented project coming from a punk rock background.
How about from playing instrument though to, you know, working on keyboards and working with turntables, doing the DJ thing?
Yeah, that I've managed to get around the limitation that the only instrument I know how to play is guitar.
Really?
So I basically play keyboards with like two fingers. And when we play live, I actually have a series of color-coded tape and numbers on my keyboard, so I remember what to play. But that was part of what made it interesting for me, because I was really not interested in having a music career anymore after Six Finger Satellite. But sort of getting into this world of electronic music production made the whole thing like exciting and interesting for me again.
Well, listening to what you do now, it seems like you have a pretty eclectic musical background. I'm wondering what you grew up listening to. What were the things that kind of penetrated the most deeply?
It's funny. I was really into music from a young age. And of course, it's always the music that your parents have lying around. Well, it was back then. I mean, I'm 46 and we didn't have the internet in the 70s. So I remember actually that Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Ah, yes,
was my
I remember
first
it well.
Record I was obsessed with, which is really pretty dark for like an 8-year-old,
yeah,
you know, or 10-year-old.
Playing it on the family console?
Yeah, it was one of those things you lifted up the lid and put the record in.
Yeah.
And when I started making music as the Juan McLean, when I was making my first bits of music, I discovered that you could, by using only the black keys on the keyboard, you could play the melody to the song Bridge Over Troubled Water. And I don't, so actually my entire first album is made using only the black keys on the keyboard.
Wow.
Because of that. So it's one of those funny things that this very early influence kind of crept back in.
Well, now you've sampled everyone from like Yoko Ono to Daft Punk. I even heard a little Stevie Nicks somewhere, I think.
Yeah, I'm a huge Fleetwood Mac fan. And Nancy is too.
Nancy Wang, that's your creative partner in the Juan McLean.
Right.
Wonderful vocalist. She used to be with the LCD Sound System.
Yep.
But playing as a musician, you're also, you know, a live music. And I'm now wondering what, as a DJ, how you compare that kind of performance aspect.
Well, DJing actually is a performance. I think there are a lot of people who think that you're basically like a human jukebox, like maybe just pressing play on something and listening to a song. But especially for someone like me, like I still play vinyl records when I DJ. And in the process of getting those like two records to work together is a very sort of physical thing and dynamic process that's a lot like, you know, playing an instrument.
I imagine that a lot of bands, you know, they typically want all eyes on them. And as a DJ, are you looking for a different response? I mean, are you casting out and looking at the throngs kind of moving to see how that's going?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interactive, well, it should be a very interactive process. And I really like being, you know, right there in the thick of it when I'm DJing. It's a very utilitarian thing. I mean, you're there basically to make people dance.
Hmm.
And that's something that I really liked about it. Coming from an indie rock background where I got really used to looking out, and you know, even during your best shows, you're looking out over like 1,000 people with their arms folded watching you.
It must be pretty powerful though to command so many people. I mean, they're
yeah,
all
I
responding
so.
To you.
Yeah, and it's I find it both more gratifying when it's going very well to DJ than playing live. And it's also the most demoralizing when it goes badly. Like every once in a while, I'll end up back in my hotel room after I've DJed and it's not gone well, like on my laptop researching graduate schools. Like I just don't want to do this anymore.
It's always graduate school.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to some more music from the Juan McLean. This is Love Stops Here.
Memory buys the time. Bye.
I'm hearing a little more New Order than Simon and Garfunkel.
But it's funny. It's definitely goes back to early New Order. I saw New Order live in like 1985, I think.
Wow.
So yeah, but I actually think they're not that dissimilar. Like they both evoke this kind of like melancholy tone that I've always been really drawn to.
Well, I want to talk about your melancholy tone. I know that this album was 5 years in the making. And one of your band members, the drummer Jerry Fuchs, had a tragic death in 2009. Mm-hmm. Any correlation there between the melancholy?
I think the melancholy was always there. But it's funny, that song that we just played, Love Stops Here, was started as a kind of tribute to Jerry. And kind of this, you know, we were actually in the middle of touring when Jerry died in 2009, touring as a live band. And it, of course, immediately stopped, and I just picked up with DJing. I really was playing as much as I possibly could and was away from home as much as I could possibly be away from home. And that song kind of started with this idea of, you know, like sitting on airplanes and looking over and where Jerry would usually be sitting next to me, you know, he wasn't there anymore.
Well, I'm thinking of the lyrics of that song and other songs. Let's say electronic dance music is not known for its literary value, necessarily.
Definitely
you know, the lyrics are almost immaterial. You seem to place a lot of emphasis on the lyrics. Is there something you're wanting to communicate?
Well, Nancy and I talked about this very early on in the Juan McLean, because I remember we came up with a list of things that dance music was usually about lyrically, and it was like party themes, like having a good time, and then sort of abstract things that didn't mean anything. And we made a decision to always write about very personal things, even to the point of it being kind of embarrassing. And it's also, I think, a time, and this might still be true, when irony seemed to be a really cheap crutch that people were using. I mean, both in, you know, song lyrics and even in the literary world. And I was always a bit turned off by that. It always seemed like a bit of a cop-out. I think it's a lot harder to just come out and say something honestly and with integrity, even though you could be opening yourself up to criticism.
Let's hear a little bit more. This is A Simple Design. Nancy Wang here on lyrics. To achieve emotional resonance in dance music, or sincerity, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to achieve in any genre of music, but particularly in dance or electronic music, because you have this built-in limitation of using electronic instruments, which are hard to coax a kind of emotional feeling out of them, I guess.
Is it ever odd to see people dancing to it, you know, thinking like, wait, this is about the human condition?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. I mean, that's the trick, really, is like, you don't want to be, you know, how do you make something that's still kind of dancey, I guess, or works in a visceral way without just being entirely heady and intellectual?
Juan McLean is a DJ, producer, electronic musician, and creative force behind The Juan McLean with Nancy Wang. He joined us in studio for the release of their album, In a Dream. If you'd like to catch The Juan McLean live, they're performing at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth tonight. Details at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
so much for listening today. There's much more to hear at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any part of the show, you can catch up by subscribing to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it on iTunes or find the link at wordofmouthradio.org. We invite you to check it out because, like DJ Juan McLean, Word of Mouth feeds off of the environment and generates ideas from right here in New Hampshire. But we're eager to share what we do in the borderless world of the internet. So if you listen to the Word of Mouth podcast, please write a review for it. That helps Word of Mouth swim up to the surface of the deep sea of podcasts. The best local secrets get traction by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Spread it around. And please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.